Get ready for the only show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible. With the latest in sales technologies and your own personal guide, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this nice, beautiful day in Laguna Beach. Not a cloud in the sky. Can see all the way out to San Clemente Island. Beautiful out there. You know, up and down the 405, sometimes we come up with some very, very interesting people to talk with. You don't always know exactly what's behind the door to a company when you begin to talk with them. Sometimes what's going on in our backyard is very significant in terms of global presence, in terms of significant change in companies, and very often behind that are people who've had lots of experience in growing public and private businesses, especially using global sales channel development. And that takes, in today's marketplace, innovative new product development and always an improvement in operational effectiveness. Now, I've known our guest today for a number of years, and I've watched him as he's moved through a variety of companies and always made a very significant impact in that company's top line, bottom line, and also in their management effectiveness. So it's going to be very interesting today to hear how Cosworth Americas and Cosworth Global is being affected by the presence of one of Orange County's fine turnaround people, Hal Reisinger. So, Hal, welcome to the show.
How are you, Will?
Very good. Very good. So, tell us a little bit about what Cosworth Americas is, what it has been, and if you can, to the extent that you're comfortable, tell us what it's going to be.
Cosworth in the Americas had principally focused on motorsport through the CART and Champ race series that preceded what's now known as IndyCar. And the primary focus at the time when it was owned by Ford was engine development, manufacturing, and overhaul. We have since and are trying to rapidly accelerate the development of products and systems for growth markets in automotive, but now production vehicle as well as motorsport, and also defense markets. So we try to leverage the historic motorsport brand and our strong mechanical and electronic engineering core competencies and come out with new products that add value to our customers.
Well, there's some pretty impressive pictures on the webpage, the homepage of the website for Cosworth, of some pretty dramatic vehicles there. So you guys are really doing a lot, extending into a lot of different areas, aren't you?
Everybody likes fast cars, and the key is leveraging motorsport technology in the other markets. One example of what we're recently accomplishing is taking an existing 1600cc engine block and by turbocharging and supercharging it, generating 500 horsepower for a high-efficiency production vehicle.
Uh-huh. Now that, when you say production, that means something's coming right off the line in Detroit.
Correct. Detroit and overseas.
Now, how is this going to affect efficiency, gas mileage, things like that?
What we typically try to accomplish with motorsport drivetrains is you need to get more out of less. So if you're limiting the size of the engine, and many of the motorsport series are now trying to become greener along with the rest of the world, then it's how do you optimize the size, the weight, and the output. If you're capable of doing that, then ultimately in a production vehicle platform level, you'll achieve greater outputs with less power requirements. So that's how we transition the motorsport engineering development into production vehicle platforms.
Okay, so you're contributing to the car manufacturers desire. I wish it were desire, but it's certainly the requirement for them to push up their gas mileage.
That, and it's much less expensive to make a four-cylinder engine than an eight-cylinder engine. And I think in Europe, where you see a large number of turbocharged diesel four-cylinder engines that get 50 miles to the gallon while also producing significant horsepower output, we need to emulate that in the Americas as well.
So talk to me a little bit about where do you see Cosworth Americas going in the next 5 years?
We've been successful in spite of the economy in large part because we have a very focused diversification plan. So we've taken these same mechanical and electronic engineering capabilities and we're applying them to everything from compact two-stroke diesel engines for UAVs and power generation to electronic systems for military crew and vehicle survivability. So we're ensuring that we've got targeted markets that have growth potential that we can add high value profitably and then reinvest in the business so we can continue to execute the plan.
Now, where does Cosworth Americas sit in the whole family of Cosworth companies? Is this an American company? Is this a European company?
Ultimately, we are owned by a U.S. holding company, but there is a parent U.K. holding company that oversees all Cosworth Group companies. There's two companies in the U.K., there's one in India, and there's two in the United States with three facilities that are responsible for the Americas. The companies have tended to develop their own centers of excellence in certain areas. And, for example, in America, because of the market potential for defense, both in electronics and UAV engines, Cosworth America will be a center of excellence from a design, manufacturing, and support standpoint because we represent the largest market share. Conversely, the UK facilities, which have a much stronger presence in Formula One, for example, and other motorsports, they'll maintain their engineering center of excellence for those markets.
So maybe other people know, but what is UAV?
Unmanned aerial vehicle. You also will hear it referred to as UAS or unmanned aerial system. Most people know them as drones. And because of the cost of life and the danger that's represented in some of the terrains that we now have to conduct surveillance and military operations, there is an increase in defense budgets for these vehicles that don't have personnel on board but are capable of either conducting surveillance or now they're adding armaments to these same aircraft. And there is a single fuel directive issued by the Department of Defense that necessitates that they run on jet fuel and diesel fuel. And we have a patented engine that is a non-spark compression ignition two-stroke multiple fuel engine that the government is right now finding quite a bit of favor with.
Wow, very interesting. It's interesting. In 1 week, I've heard you and a client of mine both working very heavily in the UAV niche. They're a plastic fabrication company, and they do a lot of the fabrication of the small parts, the grommets, the screws, all of these pieces that go into the UAVs. So interesting.
You need to introduce me to them so we can network together.
I think that would be a good thing. I think that'd be a very good thing. I'd be happy to. Now, My producer is frantically asking me to get you to tell us about the rocket car. Did you guys set a land speed record?
The Bloodhound. It's an interesting use of Cosworth technology. We actually use a race car engine to power the pump that provides the rocket fuel for the Bloodhound, and that's our involvement in it. We actually use the Bloodhound as a platform to develop engineering internships and to promote engineering scholars, particularly in the UK. So it was quite an interesting event. I was in London at the time, and to see this vehicle and the interest that it generates from young potential engineers who find it a lot more exciting to work on a Bloodhound than they do a four-cylinder, compact, fuel-efficient car.
that might go on a lawnmower, huh?
Exactly.
Well, that's good. Now, tell us a little bit about the CEO of Cosworth. I mean, he seems to be very, very creative.
He's very creative. He's technology-driven, but he has an uncharacteristic drive and ability to balance being technology-driven with being market-driven. When the company first got involved in the UAV space, it was his insistence that we create, through our own internal development efforts, a compact heavy fuel engine as a demonstrator to generate interest in the military. And when he approached the engineers, who had been accustomed to designing race car engines, they said, "We don't know anything about two-stroke engines." And he said, "Well, learn." And necessity is the mother of invention. So Tim has an uncanny and uncharacteristic ability, I find, among CEOs and chairmen to combine both the technology drive and the market drive.
Now, I'm noticing that some of the notes that I took, that the company, the group itself, it not only is profitable. I mean, you guys came away from Ford in 2005?
Correct.
And you're showing 50% growth last year?
That's correct. And I think one of the things that attracted me to Cosworth is, as you mentioned at the introduction, I'm motivated by turnaround and growth opportunities. And in this particular situation, currently owned by wealthy industrialists, their interest is in building a company and the employees that drive that growth, so all of the profits get reinvested into the company without any interest or need on the part of ownership to draw the profits out of it.
That's a wonderful position to be in.
So I enjoy it very much.
So talk to me a little bit about about some of the issues in taking a company that has been that was heavily involved with a giant like Ford Motor Company, and then beginning to create a company of its own. And the kind of momentum, what have you been observing, and what kinds of puzzles have you been solving?
I think culturally there's a big change to have accountability and to recognize that the company will be able to fund growth bootstrapped only through its own profitability, unlike perhaps the past, when owned by a large company and many car manufacturers use motorsport as a marketing vehicle. In this particular case, we are now a for-profit, and the funds that are necessary to continue to invest in growth need to come from our own profitability. So we try to create a culture where things are, as we would say, reasonable but not comfortable, so that it drives cost efficiencies, whether it's in product development, operational excellence, and otherwise, so that we can be more accountable and good stewards for the assets that we have.
All right. Those are wonderful words. Can you talk a little bit about what that means in terms of a management change and how you've implemented that?
I think culturally, if I don't embody and represent the culture as the leader of the company, then nobody's going to. So when I express or demonstrate value in the assets of the organization, hopefully that demonstrates to all the members of the team that if I find value in an asset, that I want them to find value and to communicate why. So I think it's everything from realizing the actual cost of transactions, of scrap, and demonstrating to them or articulating what could we otherwise do with those monies, whether it's continue to fund matching 401ks, provide superior health benefits, or fund the next product development program that's going to give them opportunities to continue to develop new skills that increase their earning power.
Now, accountability, that's not something that we automatically associate with Ford Motor Company.
You said that, I didn't.
you didn't contradict me.
No, and I don't know. I think it was a different time and a place. I think when you're dealing with the desire and need to internally fund growth and to build a sustainable business model, then that has to come from somewhere. And if you don't have a kind of accountability from the top down and the bottom up, then the organization could have the potential to become a runaway freight train when it comes to cost, quality, processes. So it's not just financially, but it's process and system as well.
Well, now, could that be generalized to the American economy today? Is that part of what we're seeing as the economy goes through what it goes through? Is that part of the answer to how we're going to get out, how we're going to move forward and thrive, is stronger accountability?
I think to a large extent. I had the pleasure of spending some time with some executives from General Motors the other night, and we were discussing the turnaround at General Motors, emerging from bankruptcy, and how they felt about where the company stood today. And they felt that going through that painful process had brought them to a much stronger and healthier foundation. It's unfortunate that it can become necessary for organizations to go through that to arrive at a point where there's accountability, there's key performance indicators, there's solid foundations for growth. But I think that these market conditions are going to drive more and more companies, and ultimately we'll see who survives and thrives, to adopt different cultures and approaches because of what they're experiencing.
Yeah, there's certainly the perfect storm syndrome. I mean, you have a number of different things that come together to influence a company's progress, whether it's going to thrive or dissipate. But I'm wondering if what we're talking about here in terms of accountability, in terms of being aware that the resources for growth are internal resources. They're probably not going to be a big IPO sitting out there a couple of years from now, and they're probably not going to be an angel investor over here who's going to make it smooth for us. But they're going to be companies, the thriving companies are companies that have made that switch to understanding that the source of resources is within the company. And it's growing that company that's going to make that difference.
I think people realize that. I mean, we're fortunate. We're in an economy and in a geography where, what, the unemployment rate is reportedly 12%, and we're hiring. So when the staff can connect the dots with excellent benefits, a company that's investing in growth, that is hiring, and we are clearly communicating that we're capable of doing so because we all practice accountability in what we do, how we utilize the assets that we're fortunate to have available to us, I think they get it. So we're fortunate, I think, that we're creating this culture where people understand that.
So talk to me about what you mean by accountability.
It's fairly simple to me, and that's do what you say you're going to do. And again, I think it's my responsibility and obligation to demonstrate that first and foremost. So if there's a business plan or an action necessary, I communicate it to the company. If it happens, we talk about how it happened, how they shared in it and supported it. If it didn't, I hold myself accountable in front of the staff and say, this is what we set out to do. This is why it didn't happen. This is what we learned from it and what we're going to make sure is done differently in the future. But here at Cosworth, every member of the management team has their own set of performance objectives that are directly tied to the company performance goals and objectives. And everyone understands how they're tied together. And we meet and discuss regularly those KPIs. They, in turn, communicate them to their staffs, and we broadcast it using our computer technology so everybody's aware of what needs to be done to meet our goals. And I think it translates, if there is an accountability and something doesn't take place, they're all going to understand the impact on the ultimate performance of the company.
Mm-hmm. So what I've heard so far is that making that that there was the necessity for making a significant change in the culture of the company from whatever it was to one where there's a high degree of accountability. And one of the ways that you're doing that is through modeling from the top. Model accountability over and over again and point to it. What I'm hearing is there's a second thing that you're doing, which is to measure, monitor, and report on the performance of every manager based upon what they said they would do. Is that right?
That's right. And I emphasize to the managers, and I think every employee, wherever possible, should be incentivized to perform. A manager does not want to be evaluated on subjective performance. So I communicate to them that having objective performance goals, these KPIs, benefits them as well as the company and myself. So we're not sitting down at some point saying, you didn't do your job because we didn't have enough throughput last week. And, well, what is not enough throughput? So I think they need to be quantified, and they need to be realistic, time-bound, objective goals that are mutually agreed upon. But they have to be quantifiable and objective.
So you said some very significant things there. I mean, you talked about the quality of the goal being time-bound, having a distinct beginning, middle, and end. Being an objective, measurable goal. And you also said mutually agreed upon. These are not goals that come down. This is not a quota. This is not a demand. This is not an expectation apart from the conversation where that manager agrees to do that freely. Is that right?
Yes. And I think top-down goals sound good for a leader to be able to state, this is my expectation. However, I've found in my experience it becomes far too easy for a member of the staff, when that goal isn't met, to say, well, That was your goal, not mine. And again, I think they need to be aggressive and reasonable, but not necessarily a goal that somebody's comfortable with. So I set aggressive goals for the company that I know are a challenge, and I want to be challenged, and I want staff to be challenged. But it, for me to turn around and say, you're going to sell X, and you're going to build Y, and the cost will be Z, when those goals may not be met, it's far too easy for those members of the staff to take the position, you established something that wasn't reasonable to begin with.
Uh-huh. Now, I'm getting the sense that these evaluations are not annual evaluations.
Yeah, I don't believe in that. if I waited a year to tell somebody they did a good job, shame on me. If I waited a year to say that the job wasn't being done, and again, that's with the assumption that we've established these quantifiable objectives, then shame on both the employee and myself. And I have what I call a three-question-in-the-mirror policy. And if we're not achieving or performing as we expect to, then when it comes to any particular individual or group, the first question I have to ask myself is, did we understand and communicate clearly quantifiable goals and objectives? The second would be, did we ensure that we had adequate training, support, and resources? Now, if the answer to the first two questions is yes, then we have another type of discussion, because it would appear that everything should have been in place to meet our goals. But I'm responsible for the first two questions, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the third question.
Well, the third question is, why didn't you perform? You know, the first two questions are directed at myself. The third is, we've given clear objectives. We've given tools, resources, and support necessary. It becomes then an unfortunate question of performance on the part of the individual that's responsible.
Mm-hmm. All right, I've got some questions. I've got that. This is a very interesting discussion. I've got some thoughts about that and some ideas, and I got some questions for you. Can you stick around after the break, and we can go a little bit deeper?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's stop for a moment and hear from our friends over at Sandler Training.
Hello, this is Bob Anoni with Sandler Training, here to talk to you about rule number one. You have to learn to fail to win. Think about learning how to walk or riding a bike. When you first started to learn how to walk, of course you fell. And you fell again, you fell again, but eventually you mastered the art of walking. Same thing with riding a bike or driving a car or making cold calls or starting up a business. Henry Ford failed four times before he succeeded. Thomas Edison worked almost 10 years on the light bulb before he succeeded. They weren't failures, but they were willing to risk failure to find out what they were truly capable of achieving. At Sandler, we ask you to learn from your failures and understand that the process is failing, not you as a person. You are not a failure. The process that you are using isn't apparently the right one to produce the results that you're trying to produce. So if the cold call isn't going well, we'd ask you to examine the sales process that you're using. Don't get discouraged if your sales call doesn't go well. Learn from it. So again, Sandler rule number one is you have to be willing to fail and risk failure in order to win, to find out what you're truly capable of achieving.
All right. So now it's very interesting when you those three questions, Hal, that you put for us. Oh, by the way, we're talking to Hal Reisinger from Cosworth Americas about this shift from, I don't know what we want to call it, a culture of what would it be if you didn't have accountability?
I would just consider it a culture.
What would you call that, Hal?
From what one might consider unlimited resources to a culture of limited resources that you have to maximize.
And we were in that place back in the 40s and 50s. We were struggling with that. I mean, that was part of our culture, was we had limited resources, but we had great expectations. I think that was true all the way through the 60s and the 70s. Something changed around the 70s, 80s, somewhere. Something changed in there about believing we had unlimited resources. And that's not true anymore. We don't believe that anymore, do we?
I don't think we believe it. I think hindsight's always 20/20, but I'll always look towards leadership to make sure that, you know, the right message is communicated and the right vision for the future. And I think there were cycles that repeat themselves, whether it's economic cycles, civil rights cycles, through countries. And I think it's unfortunately our human nature to develop some type of complacency that we then have to experience. And, you know, our faith also talks about this. But using the challenges to make us stronger and perhaps have a stronger appreciation as well for the things that we do have.
Yeah. All right. So back to the three questions that you have now. Clear goals. You know, did we have clear? Thinking a little bit about the little thing we had from Sandler, talking about you have to fail to learn to win. Is that part of your culture there? Is part of this accountability to help people to learn that when they do fail, they can learn something from that?
Yes, and interesting. I ran a company once. I hope to put the same type of tool in place here, where during the employee meetings, we had a giraffe with a $50 bill, and we used to award it to the employee that stuck their neck out the most. And
right. What
we wanted them to do, this was more about what we learned from failures than successes. We had our Employee of the Month award and some other things. But we wanted to encourage in an open public forum with all the members of the team, people to talk about, I tried this, it didn't work, this is what I learned from it, this is how I'll use that knowledge going forward. And we used to have a lot of fun with it, and I think it showed that there was a humility and a benefit to not only trying new things, but that the failure, as you mentioned in the Sandler ad, was more often than not in the process, not in the individual.
Uh-huh. Yes. And so that's why I was really interested in this third question. Did we have clear goals? Did we have the training and support? Mm-hmm. And then why didn't you? What do you hear as the answers to that question?
Some people need support in execution. You know, there's an expression, vision without execution is hallucination. And mm-hmm. I think that some people need help with organizational skills and development.
Mm-hmm.
Some people need help and support with development of the actual action plan, the step-by-step on how we're going to go from point A to point B. My responsibility is to make sure that the management team is getting that type of support, whether it's from myself, internal or external resources, and ensuring that we don't repeat the same mode of failure.
Uh-huh. And so what you're really doing with that question then is you're not trying to get that individual to somehow cough up my responsibility, I just didn't do it. That's not very helpful. I mean, that's just, that's tantamount to pushing them out the door. What I'm hearing is that what you're looking for is, tell me what parts of the process didn't work to accomplish the goal. What sorts of things need to change for us to be able to accomplish that goal? Which puts you right back into what kind of training and support. How do we need to change our training and support? And maybe we have some shorter term goals as we move through this learning process. Would that make sense?
Yes. You know, how do you eat elephant a bite at a time? If it takes measuring the actions and the results in smaller increments, whether it's to build confidence within the individual or the team, then that's what you do and how you proceed. If our hiring process is good and we have sufficiently matched the performance requirements and expectations with an individual's validated experience and successes, and also ensured the cultural fits there, then it would be, in the majority of cases, process related.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, so I remember several years ago there was a lot of talk about an organization being a learning organization. Would you say that's what you want Cosworth Americas to be?
Absolutely. And I often refer. No, please go ahead.
No, you go right ahead. You've got the mic.
I always call myself a student of the market, and I figure if I can learn, then everybody can learn, and especially if you're embarking on a diversification plan that necessitates that you apply something to a new area, target market, et cetera, then we all have to learn. We have to learn what are the needs of the market, how do we fill the needs of the market, what's the product, place, packaging, price, et cetera. So, yes, I think, and hopefully that's the exciting part. I think some people are resistant to change, but they are resistant to change because they think that it's a threat to them. We need to communicate it's actually an opportunity for them and to give them some tangible examples of how it's an opportunity.
And it seems to me that that's part of our struggle right now with this resistant high unemployment number, that some of the people weren't let go because there was just a shrinking economy. Some of the people were let go because their skill set and their ability to change didn't match what was necessary. And that means that as an economy in general, that's part of our changing culture, is that we're moving into new space. Cosworth America is moving into new space. Seems to me that the country is moving into new space. Would that make sense to you?
Yes, and I do some volunteer work as a career coach, and we see this very often, that there are jobs, but there aren't necessarily people trained to fill the jobs. And in the Michigan marketplace, where there is a demand for people that have skills that support the wind energy market, there's a gap because the same people that are unemployed because of perhaps the automotive market don't have the skills necessary to transition into a different industry or marketplace.
You're not saying they don't have the skills right now to do it. You're saying they don't have the skills to learn how to make that transition.
Or the resources. I think the typical employee that has been trained over a long period of time to perform a function, we supported that employee in learning how to perform that function. We need to support that employee in learning how to perform a new function. And I think whether it's a professional or a social obligation, I think it's something we have to do.
That's interesting. That's a very interesting point. Talk a little bit more about social. Did I hear you use the word moral? Social obligation.
Social obligation.
Uh-huh.
I think that we need to be, whether it's through training and supporting people, we're trying to outline a program here at Cosworth to encourage employees to do volunteer work.
Uh-huh.
And to give them some type of credit, whether it's vacation or otherwise, for volunteer work performed, whether it's being a good environmental citizen. And I think it's important you can be socially conscious and have a profitable company with a positive culture at the same time. I think it's just you have to make sure it's woven into the fabric of the company and the culture.
And that's not something that just naturally happens. That's something that people make a choice to do.
Yes.
Would you say that choice has been made up and down the line for Cosworth, or is that something just at Cosworth Americas?
No, definitely up and down the line. As I referred to earlier with the Bloodhound program, one of the driving forces for our involvement, that's not a profitable activity for Cosworth, but it raised the visibility of what engineering expertise is capable of. And at our corporate headquarters outside of London, there was a education day and program that revolved around the Bloodhound. So we're trying to do that to inspire people to become engineers, to promote higher education. So I see it throughout the organization.
Uh-huh. Okay. What, you know, I guess let's go to your three questions. Do you think we as a country, as a the business sector of the country, do you think we have clear goals about what it is that we're trying to accomplish?
I think some look at survival. I think some people spend a lot of time in the business but not on the business. But I think if you're not able to establish these appropriate milestones, I don't know how you get from point A to point B. And I think that there's many small businesses that I see and small business leaders that want to do the right thing, that have the right ideas, but perhaps could benefit from coaching or support on laying out a plan that gets them from point A to point B.
All right. So maybe the goals are there, but they're not getting the necessary training and support, the resources to help them in this new economy to accomplish those goals.
It's certainly one area that I think we can improve.
Uh-huh. Because what I'm noticing is that this whole notion of as a company, our job is to pay the least amount of taxes possible. That's ultimately not going to work out, will it?
No. You know, even when you hear Warren Buffett admit that he doesn't pay enough taxes, it is an unfortunate issue with the, I think, our political system right now, where people spend more time and effort opposing one another than realizing mm-hmm. what's the need and benefit to the people that we're supposed to serve. And I think whether you're a politician or a company leader, you know, we're all serving someone. And
I
think there's a responsibility and obligation that goes along with it. It goes back to the part I mentioned earlier about being a good steward. I can't expect employees to be good stewards with our assets if I'm not a good steward with our asset.
Yeah.
But I think we all have to do our share. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that there's something I feel when I listen and look. Something comes to me about clear goals. A couple of years ago, I looked at what's going on in California, and what I realized is California, Orange County, and in many businesses, we're not really asking where will we be 5 to 10 years from now. Where do we want to be 5 to 10 years from now? We're, like you said, some people focusing on survival, some people focusing on an ideological position or a personal position, and I don't know that there's a clear sense of where do we want to take this thing? Where do we want to go? But I'm hearing that from you about Cosworth Americas.
Not just where do we want to go, but how do we want to get there?
Mm-hmm.
I find that if I speak with the staff and talk about the longer-term plans, but I don't communicate how we're going to achieve these milestones and achieve our goals and fulfill the plans, there's a disconnect. So it's fine and well to turn around and say, whether it's on an individual basis or company basis or otherwise, that we're going to seek to become something, but at the end of the day, even if you're, I'm a sports fan, if you have a team that's 0-16 and you communicate to the team that you're going to be undefeated next year, you probably need to explain to them how that's going to happen.
Yes.
For either from your own credibility's sake or from the ability of the team to understand what they need to do to go undefeated.
And then, if we're using your plan, then you'd ask them if they want to go along with you, right?
Correct. And, you know, sometimes people don't, and that's okay, too. I found that there have been times when if it isn't a good match between the organization and the employee, it's better for their benefit as well as the organization's to identify that sooner rather than later. And mm-hmm. I've had people that have worked for me that we learned that together. We helped guide them to a place that was probably better for them, and we continued a relationship, and they were much healthier as a result. So
yeah, that's good stewardship. Good stewardship, helping them model that good stewardship so somebody's taking care of themselves. I mean, it doesn't really work if somebody's laboring under somebody else's expectation and they're not buying into it. They haven't agreed to it. They don't believe that they can do it, and maybe they don't even want to do it. I wonder how we communicate this to others in such a way that they would find it a winsome direction for their companies. I haven't come across a lot of companies who have the kind of momentum and leadership able to articulate in the way that you're articulating this. Do you find other companies who would say they're doing similar things in their own ways?
I think there are some. I try to develop relationships not only within the industries and trade associations, but I also, for example, belong to a CEO roundtable, and I'm fortunate to share experiences, successes, and failures, I might add, mm-hmm. with mutually respected colleagues where I can witness their experiences and hopefully similar successes, and you try to build out from that. And through some of the trade associations I've had the pleasure of being involved in over the years, whether it's for the benefit of the industry or the members of the association, hopefully you share these same stories, discussions, successes, and hopefully, if you're bold enough, failures. So that's one way that I try to do it, by learning from others, building the network out, guest speaking, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that sounds like you're really committed to this whole idea, not only for yourself or for Cosworth, but also for others in the environment. It's almost dare I say, evangelistic, huh?
Whether it's personally or professionally, I think I've been fortunate enough to experience certain things that I believe that we have an obligation to give back to one another and share. So I try to exhibit that personally and professionally.
What would you say some of your greatest successes in the last year have been? And you know what the next question is going to be, right?
We had the opportunity to land a Tier 1 supply contract with one of the Big Three.
Big Three?
Automotive manufacturers.
Uh-huh.
And when I first presented the opportunity to the team, one of the key members of the management team said, his exact words were, "I feel like I'm pulling a whale in a rowboat." And when he said that, I said, think of how good you're going to feel when you get the boat to the shore. And he said, that's if it doesn't sink first. And I said, well, we're going to have to row smarter, and we're going to have to row faster. And people at the time, as a leader, my greatest satisfaction is seeing people accomplish things they didn't otherwise think they could, whether it's individually or collectively. And in this particular case, I think some of the members of our team were overwhelmed at the prospect of what it took to actually land that contract and execute. And we are, and this is through solid program management that is done by others, not by myself, but I'm proud to say that we are on track with the project. We not only landed it, but have met all of the milestones that we've established and agreed to thus far. So I would say in the last year, not only from a business sense, because it gives us the potential to literally quadruple a business, but from a company culture and employee satisfaction sense, that I would have to say was one of the greatest things in the past year.
So you got the whale to the shore and you didn't sink your boat.
Got the whale to the shore.
Good. Well, and you didn't sink your boat, did you?
No, and interestingly enough, the team decided they were going to call the project Marlin. So the internal project name is Marlin over the whole boat story.
Well, that's good. I'm glad it wasn't Melville. Or Ishmael.
Yeah, and they're very good. Committed. It's been a great thing for the company.
That's wonderful. All right, so here's the next question. It's a tough one, right? Mm-hmm. What would you say some of your greatest learning opportunities, what have been some of the obstacles, some of the failures that were there?
I would say the ability to make personnel changes rapidly. I think we all, there's a subjective side to personnel changes and building management and winning teams. And I have a colleague I respect very much, and he, like others, subscribes to the theory, you know, fire fast and hire slow. I think from a, whether it's a sentimental perspective or otherwise, we, and I share that with others, I'm sure, probably struggle more with the former than the latter, and I think we have a tendency to make the changes slower than we should and to hire too fast. So I think that's always an area of improvement for any hiring manager.
Right. So hiring slowly and firing quickly. Sometimes working with the managers in the management program, what I ask them to do is to take out a sheet of paper and list all of the people in the level below them and tell me which one that they would fire quickly right now. And it's amazing. They all can circle the one, and maybe it's two, that they would fire immediately, right?
Yes, and the other unfortunate part, when you talk about unemployment, retraining people, there are people that are now amongst the unemployed that should have been either retrained or redirected, but regretfully became expendable during these necessary reduction in forces that probably weren't sufficiently equipped to perform before they got let go, and now are certainly not equipped to regain or be reemployed in a very competitive workforce that requires new skills.
Yeah. Boy, things have certainly changed dramatically in the last 3 to 5 years for all of us. Yeah. Every single one of us. It's amazing. Well, listen, Hal, this has been wonderful. I really do appreciate you taking your time, especially with that whale out there flapping on your beach.
Like I said, we're fortunate to have it, so I'm not going to regret any of it.
That's wonderful. Is there anything you'd like to share with other CEOs in California?
That I am a firm believer that outlook determines outcome, and if you think you can't, you're right. So the idea that we have an economic climate that doesn't support growth, I don't pay attention to that. I think that we've got a capable workforce. There's market opportunities. If we make sure that the core competencies of our organization are aligned with growth opportunities, you got a good plan, you're going to be successful.
Wonderful. Thanks, Hal, so much for being with us. It's been a wonderful time spending with you. And congratulations on that whale.
Thanks, Will. It was my pleasure.
Good boy. Looking forward to talking with you again soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. A thriving company, part of a global company, ultimately headquartered in the UK, but making huge risks and finding huge successes in the marketplace today, quadrupling their business in an economy that many say is not conducive to growth. I think it's a challenge for all of us to take a look at what is it that is limiting us. Do we have some clear goals? Do we have the kind of training and support for ourselves and for those that are working with us to be able to move forward, even if it's incrementally toward accomplishing those goals? And are we holding ourselves and others accountable for what they said they would do? If we did those three things, I think we'd make some major inroads into this mentality of we're still waiting to see what's going to happen in the economy, to changing, to understand that we have the opportunity to make that new economy. So anyway, that's what the Pilgrim on the 405 is finding as he wanders up and down the 405 and knocks on doors and talks with people, and I encourage you to do the same. Look forward to talking with you again next week on Pilgrim Talks.
You've been listening to the only show that takes you past the frontiers of what you thought were possible, with a look at today's technology and your own personal Pilgrim on the 405, right here on octalkradio.net.